All right, this is the Michael Slate Show, and I'm your host, Michael Slate. We've got an interesting show today and plenty of time to bring it to you, so let's get going. At the back end of the show, we're going to hear two excerpts from speeches by Bob Avakian, the chairman of the Revolutionary Communist Party, and a man whose voice you've heard often here, but can never hear too often, okay? He's the most important political thinker in the world today. The first is called The Oppression of Black People and Other People of Color, and it's from the talk, Why We Need an Actual Revolution and How We Can Really Make Revolution. The second is an excerpt from his recorded talk on communism and Jeffersonian democracy. He talks about the myth of Jefferson's ideal society and the reality of slavery that provided its backbone and continues to influence and shape America as we know it today. Opening the show up, we're going to be talking about COVID-19 and the reasons behind the lopsided death rates among Latino workers and other workers of color. In LA County, people of color are dying at rates 8 times that of white residents. There may be many factors, including poor access to health care or crowded living conditions due to low wages and unemployment, or limited access to testing and vaccines. Well, right now, we're going to hear an interview I did this week with Sarah Thomason from the UC Berkeley Labor Center. We talk about the disproportionate number of Latino workers and other workers of color in what we now call essential industries, from the farm work to grocery stores. She talks about the large number of low-wage jobs in those industries, and she mentions studies of these jobs that show that the protections from the coronavirus, especially social distancing, are more difficult to arrange. All these conditions have contributed to the outrageously high death tolls we're seeing. All right, I recently discovered the UC Berkeley Labor Center and the recent work that they produced, Frontline Essential Jobs in California, a profile of job and worker characteristics. Now, this work was produced by Sarah Thomason and Annette Bernhardt, who work with the Labor Center, and they pulled together a very compelling piece of work on the subject, titled Frontline Essential Jobs in California, a Profile of Job and Worker Characteristics. And joining us to talk about this work right now is Sarah Thomason. Sarah, welcome to the show.
Thank you for having me. I'm happy to be here.
Yeah, sure. So the first piece of your work that you put out on display was samples of press coverage around Latino COVID-19 deaths hitting horrifying levels up to, you know, 1,000. Since November in LA County alone. Now, this was a sample of what was happening in early January of this year. Let's talk about that sample and then where it's going now.
Well, you know, I'm not a public health expert, so I can't really comment too much on the trends and the cases and what's likely to happen. But I can talk a little bit about what we know about the risk of exposure in the workplace.
That would be good. That'd be very good.
Yeah. So, and one, I do want to clarify that we still don't have really conclusive research that shows that workplace exposure is causing this disparity in cases where we're seeing much higher rates of infection and mortality among especially Black and Latino residents in California. And there's still a lot that we are learning about all the different factors that determine a person's risk level for being exposed to the virus. So there really could be additional factors that are contributing to this. So, for example, living in more densely populated areas or overcrowded housing may also increase your risk of exposure. Also, the type of transportation that you're using. So there's a difference if you're able to drive yourself around versus if you are relying on public transportation or using Uber and Lyft. But we do know that the workplace is an important site of infection, and we've seen a lot of media reporting on specific outbreaks in work sites, in restaurants, in grocery stores, in meat packing plants, in warehouses. And there's a couple of studies done in Asia and Europe that suggests that maybe 15 to 25% of cases are coming from workplace exposure. Not a lot of counties are reporting on this type of data, but San Diego County is an exception. And they have been reporting on where people who test positive may have become infected. They find that the workplace is a possible site of infection in about 1 out of 3 cases. So definitely this is a cause for concern. And on top of that, there's also evidence that low-wage workers and workers of color may be at increased risk of exposure at work for a few different reasons. One, they're less likely to be able to work from home. They're also more likely to be essential workers. And especially in the beginning of the pandemic, when we had these really strict shelter-in-place orders, those were primarily the only workers that were out in their original work site in the community. And three, they're also more likely to have closer physical proximity to others at work, which, a lot of research suggests also is a risk factor.
Now, along those lines, I'm just thinking about this and something that I read where, you're talking about this. And I want to know if there was any more we could dig into, because one of the major dangers at that time was the fact that, as we said, many essential workers remained in place to continue carrying out their work. Very dangerous. Yeah. And it's very dangerous, as you're pointing out, both for them and them personally, and because of the character of the work and its relationship in terms of infections that can be spread along, all the stuff that was actually basically leaving things the way they were, pushing things the way they were, actually was something that could bring and may have brought a huge problem to a lot of people that didn't even know that they were having a problem.
Yeah, well, for sure. So definitely, among essential workers, they're more likely to be low-wage workers. They're also more likely to be Black and Latino. So, and a lot of this is due to the fact that in California, much like in the rest of the country, a lot of our occupations are segregated by race and ethnicity and gender. So some of the most common occupations that are also considered essential, like food prep workers, cooks, construction laborers, personal care aides, home health aides, janitors, cashiers, those are all occupations that also are disproportionately people of color, and they also typically pay low wages. So those are the people that were considered essential and were still out in the community at their work site. And potentially having greater risk. But even beyond those workers who were considered essential, at the very beginning and during the most restrictive shelter-in-place orders, those were the only workers that were out in the community working. But for a lot of the year, we went through periods where we were opening and closing the economy to different degrees. And so there was different configurations of which groups of workers were out in the community. And so a lot of times it even went beyond just essential workers, those workers that were considered essential. And so that's why we also did an analysis looking at the entire labor force. Who are the workers who have greater physical contact, physical proximity to other people on the work site, so that in the event that everybody was back at work, even beyond essential workers, who is going to be most at risk potentially? And even there, even beyond the essential workers, we still do see a lot of inequities there, where we see that a lot of the occupations that have much closer physical proximity to others also tend to be low paid jobs and also disproportionately Black and Latino workers.
Mm-hmm. It's interesting, because that's exactly what I was going to ask you next, which was actually, this whole point that you're hitting at, and maybe we could dig into it a little bit more, but who these workers are that are pulled into all this, because people are going to work and they're going out and they're doing the job. And I don't even know how much people even understand or know about what actually is at stake when they're going out and doing this job in this kind of circumstances, because you talk about, you folks talk about this thing of both the, as you're pointing out, that the frontline essential jobs in California that are likely to be a risk of workplace exposure to the coronavirus. And then this idea and I think it's important that people get a deeper understanding of that, because too often I think we just walk around and you see the people that are out there collecting the garbage. They're doing this, they're doing that. They're doing things that are absolutely essential for basically the functioning of society. But they're actually doing this at an expense that's very, very horrible and could be very horrible and threatening to their own well-being. And so I wanted to talk about that and also who these people are that are getting pulled into all this, because it's people tend to see or hear the names and what this is or what that is, or that, yes, that's my janitor, that's this, even the idea that it's my janitor, but there's this whole idea, people need to understand who are these people and what is it that they have to actually be conscious of in their life in relation to being part of this whole mess here?
Yeah, I think that's a great question. And I think, you know, one of the really interesting things about this pandemic is that it has shown us just how critical these workers are, especially our service workers, not just for our economy, but to keep us alive, to keep us well fed, to keep us healthy. And so I think that now we are really feeling at a much more significant level than we did prior to the pandemic, just how much we need those workers. And so now people are calling these workers heroes for risking their health and their lives. And, you know, like you mentioned, what is it that they're risking? They're also potentially risking the health of their family members and the people that they live with as well in order to do their jobs. But at the same time, as we're calling them essential and heroes, we're also telling them that they aren't worthy of a living wage. You know, so I think that this is a great time to come back to the discussion about what should workers be making and what is a living wage. And, you know, there have been some local governments that have passed laws, such as in Oakland, recently passed an ordinance requiring large grocery chains to pay workers an additional $5 an hour in hazard pay as a way to try to partially compensate them for these additional health risks that they face that you mentioned. So I think that is a good start. Also, this national discussion that we're having now finally at the federal level about increasing the minimum wage is really critical. If the federal minimum wage had been keeping pace with increases in worker productivity since the 60s, it would now be over $24 an hour. So, and right now the minimum wage in California statewide is 12. Mm-hmm. So I think this is a really good opportunity for us to reconsider how we're distributing income in our country and how we're, what it means to really, truly, fairly compensate our workers.
Mm-hmm. Now, at the same time, though, the things that you've brought out that I thought were very, very important, because nobody else is bringing this out. And when you folks did your report, this is something that really stood out to me. This point about the prevalence of low wage work, focusing on the 15 largest occupations. This is a major, major, you know, this is something that people need to know about, because it's not just sort of like people go out and get jobs and they get this, you know, they're looking for work, they get a job, they're just, you know, doing their day in and day out. But there actually is, and nobody knows about, you know, what the danger is or something like this, but there's actually the prevalence of low-wage work focusing on the 15 largest occupations. That says something about the character of the society we live in right now.
Mm-hmm. No, I'm really glad that you mentioned that, because one of the misconceptions that a lot of people have is that it's okay to pay workers low wages, because these are young workers, they're just getting started, they're gaining experience, they're training, that it's just a stepping stone for later on moving into the higher paid positions. But that's just not the case. That's not how our economy is working in reality. You know, in California, in 2017, 1 out of 3 workers in California was earning low wages. So these are workers across the entire age spectrum of all races and ethnicities. And they're not just doing work that anybody could, you know, just pick up and do without any kind of training or experience. So, for example, construction workers, cooks, personal care aides that are taking care of people with disabilities, and the elderly, nurses, janitors. These are all jobs that take real skill and also experience to do well. So.
It's a very important point. Very important point to raise there. Let me remind listeners that you're tuned into the Michael Slate Show, and we're talking today with Sarah Thomason about frontline essential jobs in California, and it's a profile of job and worker characteristics. And it's actually, I tell you, this piece, folks, I read this and I thought, you know, I knew a lot about it, I was keeping in touch and stuff, but a lot of the stuff that's been put out on this report is really important for people to get and to read and to understand what the character of the society we live in, the character of the society that's being promoted and you know, around the world is like, oh, well, you know, America has this really great whatever. And then you get to see the reality, the glimpse of the reality, the real deal for what's happening for a lot of people who just basically trying to keep their life is actually costing them their lives in a lot of ways. And that's one thing I wanted to ask you about, Sarah, because you're talking about this, and you know, again, the deaths in, among Latinos in LA County from COVID rising to astonishing levels and getting it at more and more than double the rate of whites in LA County. People living in the most impoverished neighborhoods, as you hinted to, you know, people living in the most impoverished neighborhoods are averaging 36 deaths per day, 36 deaths per day per 100,000 residents. This is absolutely this is absolutely terrible. On one hand, the people who are living in the wealthiest areas are experiencing all this stuff, about 10 deaths a day. And this is what's happening to the people who have no standing in society generally.
Yeah, I think that what we're going through is, it's in some ways, it's really hard for us to even just comprehend the size of it, because it's so huge what's happening. And I think it really just is showing how deep these structural issues are, like racism and sexism and our class system are really just very embedded in our society in terms of like health and space and work. And, you know, this is the result that we're seeing from the pandemic.
Mm-hmm. Now, this isn't accidental either. I mean, in a certain sense, because as you've mentioned in, before, and I think again mentioned in the piece that you guys put together, this thing of the prevalence of low-wage work focusing on the 15 largest occupations. This is something that's actually, you can actually follow the yellow brick road and see what's going where and who's at the other end of the yellow brick road. And that's one of the things I think that people, you know, people talk about it a lot. But when you actually look at and this is what I found really, really important about what you're saying, one of the things I found really important about what you folks have been saying, it's that it's not just like saying, okay, I noticed that this is what's happening, but it's actually understanding what are the real forces out there that are carrying out the kind of, you know, working situation where people, literally a certain class of people, have to every day get up, put on their clothes, go out, and put their lives in jeopardy. In a way that doesn't have to be put in jeopardy. And I thought that was really, really important to speak to.
Yeah, I think that list, looking at that list, and like I said before, we still don't have research that shows this causal relationship between exposure at work and the disparity in the cases of COVID-19 by race and ethnicity. But there is a lot of evidence that suggests that this is, you know, potentially one major factor that's contributing to that. For example, there was a report that was just released a couple months ago by UCSF, and they compared death certificates in California from 2019 to 2020, and they were able to calculate and see the occupation on those death certificates and look at the difference in mortality rate year over year by occupation. And a lot of these same occupations that we see are the most common essential worker occupations, and that also have a high proportion of low-wage workers, are also some of the occupations that saw the biggest increase in their mortality rates. For example, the top one was cooks, and farm workers was also up there. So I think that this is something we should all be really concerned about, and I think some of the things that could be done to try to protect workers, one, employers, there's a lot that employers can do to protect their workers. They can implement policies like changing staffing and work pace and scheduling to allow for more distance between workers, putting in different kinds of protective barriers or other systems to increase safety. And two, we also need to put policies into place to protect workers. And for example, Cal OSHA did implement some new regulations last November to make employers put systems in place for identifying exposure hazards and also to check if workers have symptoms and have been doing regular testing. And also, I think it's really important that we make sure that workers have a voice in the workplace, because they know their workplace is the best. They are the experts, and they should feel safe calling to attention potentially unsafe practices and also be a part of developing the solution. So I think that's going to be really important. And LA County did pass an ordinance last fall to protect workers from retaliation. So I think that that's a good start and a good example for other counties and places to consider.
Well, let me throw a little, you know, something into the fire here, because there's also, you know, even as you're talking, I'm thinking about this thing, you know, we've been talking about who is getting really, you know, hit by this, who's on the really terrible end of things. And we're talking about the people that are living in the, you know, that we're not talking about the people who are living in the wealthiest areas, you know, because when they're there, they're getting like, you know, there's 10 deaths a day per 100,000 residents or something. But when you look at the people who are out, who are brought in to do the kind of work, the kind of work that's very dangerous on, you know, even more so than just normally. And I know one thing that you were putting forward in your, what you wrote about this, Latino residents in LA County are dying at an astonishing 8 times the rate they once did. 8 times the rate they once did. 3.5 daily deaths per 100,000 in early November to 28 deaths a day for every 100,000. A staggering increase of over 800%. That is absolutely unacceptable on any level. And I'd like to, you know, hear what you have to say about that.
Yeah, I definitely agree that it is completely unacceptable. And it's very clear that some communities in California have experienced a disproportionate amount of the burden of the pandemic, both in the infections and the deaths, like you mentioned. Also economically and financially, these are the same groups of workers that also experience the most job losses. And so in a lot of ways, many families in California and likely in LA County also are dealing with illness, either their own or a family member. They may also be dealing with unemployment and the financial repercussions of that. So maybe concerned about how they're going to pay their rent or how they're going to put food on the table for their family. So this is just, you know, it's a pandemic that's hitting people from a lot of different angles. And definitely the effects are felt very differently across different demographic groups.
Mm-hmm. And again, the death toll for these people, for the people who are getting hit the hardest, the death toll for them continues to grow. And I think I read in your report that new cases reported were daily were 15,100 people. This is unfathomable when you think about it. And California's Latino and Black residents and people with no more than a high school education suffered among the highest increase of deaths of all this. So you have this situation where you have the people who sit on top, the people who do this and do that, and their shirts are always clean and their shoes are never muddy. But then you have all these other people who are out doing all this stuff, and they are the ones who are being pushed into, not physically, but you know, basically reality, you know, pushing them into it in terms of wanting to stay alive and wanting to keep their families alive. And they're being pushed into and made to actually accept this horrifying, horrifying situation. I mean, even again, the death toll continues to grow. New cases reported daily, 15,100. This is absolutely outrageous.
Yeah, I agree. It is completely, it's a tragedy. And I hope that the best that can come of this is that we really recognize and what has happened and what has led to this, and that we use it as an opportunity as we're starting to come up with ways to pull ourselves out of this pandemic and recover our economy, that we pay particular attention to things that we can do to address the structural racism that is embedded in our economy, and, you know, to make sure that this doesn't happen again.
Mm-hmm. Now, let me remind listeners that you're tuned into The Michael Slate Show, and we're talking today with Sarah Thomason about frontline essential jobs in California, and it's a profile of job and worker characteristics. Just off of what you just raised there, I want to go back to this thought again, too, because it sticks with everything you've written through here, that California's Latino and Black residents and people with no more than a high school education suffered among the highest increases of death. You know, this is, again, on top of everything else, on top of all the, you know, all the stuff that they have to go through and what they're doing, they're suffering the highest increase of death. And that, to me, you know, says something very, very important in terms of, you know, what are we talking about here? What's actually being, you know, put on the table here in terms of, you know, who does what, when, and how, and who, you know, who suffers in relation to this? And that there's a difference between being able to work at home and work in your office and those who cannot do that due to the nature of the work that they do. And that death toll there speaks very much to that situation.
Yeah, definitely.
Yeah, it's kind of hard when you think about this, because, you know, and again, this is not to, I'm not saying this next thing to basically say, okay, well, you know, you're always arguing about it's all about race, but actually there is an element here where the people, you know, white people who are working in these kinds of jobs don't necessarily have they don't have to play the same game. They're not in the same game in terms of how they get treated. Like when you see the people that we're talking about earlier, probably a very small percentage of them are actually white people.
Exactly. A very small percentage of
the people who. I think it would seem that a very small percentage of the people, the people we're talking about earlier, of like who's suffering, who's doing what, how's it happening, who's it falling out against, and actually I would imagine that people of color are actually pretty close to the big barrel of who's being screwed over with this, who's being killed with this stuff.
Well, definitely disproportionately. I think that particularly Black and Latino people in general, and also specifically workers, have been disproportionately affected in terms of their potential risk of exposure on the workplace, less likely to be able to work from home, also more likely to work in an occupation where they are in more close contact with people. So yes, disproportionately more likely, yes. But it doesn't mean that it's completely people of color are all the ones who are getting sick and white people are not. I think that, it's just that we definitely see that it's a disproportionate effect. And we can clearly see that white people are more likely to be able to work from home during this pandemic. They're also more likely to have not lost their job. So yes, I think it's clear that there's very clear differences in how people have been affected by the pandemic.
Yeah, I agree with you wholeheartedly. I mean, I'm not saying these things that I was saying to basically say, oh, white people and all other people, people who aren't people of color are somehow just like, oh, they're just running over there like pirates with knives waiting to kill everybody. There's a reality for, you know, and even for a lot of people who are working in the business area, a lot of these people may not even know what the situation of the people, the poorer people, the people that are actually living on from hand to mouth. And I think that's one of the things that really attracted me about what you guys had written, because it actually does lay out something that tells people a truth that many, many people don't know, and including many people of all nationalities who just, they don't get a chance to see this, or they don't run into it, or they don't pay attention to it. But when it's being put in front of their face, you know, now, and the idea of actually bringing this to people is extremely important. And the last thing I wanted to ask you is, you know, you think about this, the average daily death rate among residents of LA County's poorest neighborhoods is three times as high as that in the wealthiest areas. And that begins to speak to something that we're just talking about. And I wanted to know if you had any comments you wanted to make on that, because it fits with a lot of the stuff that you were just saying, too.
Mm-hmm. Well, again, I'm not a public health expert, so I wish I could say more about a lot of the different underlying factors that are contributing to these differences that we're seeing in the infection rates and the mortality rates. But in terms of the workplace, which is more where my expertise lies and where I can better speak to, I mean, I think it's clear that, you know, for decades, and really from the history of this country, from its very founding, we have seen some very deep inequities in our economic system, in our labor market, where workers of color, especially Latinos and Black workers, earn less. And we also see a lot of occupational segregation. So actually even mostly working in different types of jobs. And so the way that has played out in this pandemic is really created this, you know, separated workers out into very different groups. We have some who didn't lose their job, are working from home, and so have been doing pretty well. Maybe some of those have really been struggling to balance childcare or dealing with kids while schools are closed. And so that is an additional burden. But, you know, they're still at home. They have less of a risk of exposure. Versus we have other workers who either have lost their jobs completely. And so now we're kind of scrambling to try to find a way to make ends meet the time when jobs are very scarce. Or workers are still on the job, but they have to go out in the community every day to do their work and interact with others. And so potentially put their health at risk, also the health of their family members at risk. And, you know, it seems very likely that those differences have contributed in some way to the differences we've seen in the mortality rates and the infection rates for Latino and Black residents of California.
Mm-hmm. Very important. All right, Sarah, I want to thank you very much for joining us today.
Yeah, thank you so much.
Sure. And is there, if people wanted to find out some of the information or some of the work that you're doing, is there a place or a way that they can find that out?
Yes, they could go to our website. We are thelaborcenter.berkeley.edu. You can find us just with a Google search for the UC Berkeley Labor Center. And there you can find more of the research that we've been doing on low-wage work, on a number of topics relating to workers and wages, and also research that we've been doing specifically on how the pandemic is affecting workers.
All right, Sarah Thomason, thank you very much for joining us today.
Thank you so much for having me.
Sure. Take care now. That was Sarah Thomason from the UC Berkeley Labor Center talking about the essential workers, low-wage workers, and the conditions of work that have contributed to workers of color dying of COVID-19 at rates many times greater than those of white residents. We're going to take a musical break and be right back, so stay tuned. Welcome back. This is the Michael Slate Show, and that was Slave Song from David Murray. Yep, David Murray, jazzman extraordinaire. Now we'll hear Bob Avakian, B.A., the chairman of the Revolutionary Communist Party, on the oppression of Black people and other people of color. This is from the talk, Why We Need an Actual Revolution and How We Can Really Make Revolution.
The oppression of Black people and other people of color. This system in this country was founded in genocide and slavery. From the beginning, African Americans and Native Americans were treated as pariahs, a caste of people less than human and not deserving of the same rights and opportunities as the European settlers of the territory. White supremacy was poured into the foundation and into every institution of the country. The uniting of the United States was accomplished through the compromise written into the founding Constitution that institutionalized slavery. And for generations, slave labor produced a great part of the wealth of this country. As I said in Basics 1-1, there would be no United States as we now know it today without slavery. That is a simple and basic truth. And then, when it was no longer possible to contain the conflicts that had been somewhat held in check by the founding compromise, the Civil War erupted between the southern slave states and the northern states, which increasingly were based on the exploitation of wage labor by capitalists. But shortly after the end of this Civil War, another compromise was engineered, which was a continuation of the original compromise under the new conditions. The country was put back together on the basis of reaffirming and reinforcing white supremacy. With the masses of black people still overwhelmingly in the South, subjugated and terrorized into second-class citizen status, exploited in conditions of near slavery and sometimes still literal slavery by white plantation and other property owners. And the land and way of life of the native peoples was further stolen through armed conquest and decimated by slaughter, confinement in reservations, and cultural genocide, which has resulted in the poverty, oppression, and repression that continues to be inflicted on Native Americans to this day. Under slavery, it was the armed patrols and militias organized by the slave owners that hunted down slaves who rebelled or just tried to escape and terrorized the masses of black people as a whole. After slavery, with Jim Crow segregation, it was the Ku Klux Klan, together with local sheriffs, who largely played this role. Today, in the conditions in which masses of black people in the ghettos of the inner cities find themselves, the role that was played in the past by the slave patrols and then the Ku Klux Klan and local sheriffs is now carried out by heavily armed urban police forces. This is a big part of the overall role of the police, which, as I said in Basics 124, is not to serve and protect the people. It is to serve and protect the system that rules over the people, to enforce the relations of exploitation and oppression, the conditions of poverty, misery, and degradation into which the system has cast people and is determined to keep people in. The law and order the police are about, with all their brutality and murder, is the law and order that enforces all this oppression and madness. In the days of slavery and then Jim Crow segregation after the Civil War, the oppressors viciously exploited and terrorized black people, brutally murdering those they saw as posing a threat or not staying in their place. But they did not kill off or incarcerate a huge part of the black population because their labor was needed as a backbone and crucial source of profit for the cotton plantations and the overall economy in the South and the country as a whole. Today, with great numbers of black people concentrated in the inner cities, and with many factories and other capitalist enterprises having moved away from the urban cores, the police have killed thousands of black people in the last few decades, and they play a key part in forcibly maintaining masses of black people in a situation where, especially youth robbed of any decent future under this system, are killing each other in the thousands, and millions are either incarcerated or in some other way under the control of the so-called justice system. Because white supremacy is such a defining part of this country, it is not just African Americans and Native Americans, but people of color generally who are subjected to discrimination, degradation, and brutality. And this applies now in acute ways to those whose roots lie in Mexico, El Salvador, and other parts of Central America and the Caribbean, which are tightly ensnared in a net of domination and exploitation by the imperialists of the USA, whose ravaging of these countries has driven many to emigrate to the US itself. White supremacy and capitalism, they have been completely interwoven and tightly stitched together through the whole development of this country down to today. To attempt to really put an end to white supremacy while maintaining the system of capitalism would tear the entire fabric of the country apart. White supremacy and capitalism. It is not possible to overcome and finally abolish the one without overthrowing and finally abolishing the other.
That was Bob Avakian, BA, the chairman of the Revolutionary Communist Party, on the oppression of black people and other people of color. This is from the talk, Why We Need an Actual Revolution and How We Can Really Make Revolution. You can hear the entire talk and much more at revcom.us. Once again, that's revcom.us. Now we'll listen to an excerpt from his recorded talk on communism and Jeffersonian democracy.
We live in a country built on and sustained by lies and distortions. At best, we're told that slavery was an unfortunate stain on the sacred democratic fabric of this country. We're told to pay more attention to that hero of equality, freedom, and democracy for all, Thomas Jefferson, than to the slaveocracy that this country was built on and that continues to influence it today. We're told to disregard the cranks who place too much emphasis on the past to just get over slavery. And more commonly these days, our schools are even teaching children that the Civil War was not about slavery, but about states' rights. Well, I hope this excerpt from Avakian's talk, Communism and Jeffersonian Democracy, can bang a few holes in all that. So let's take a listen.
In reality, Jefferson's agrarian society turned out to be a society based on slavery and ruled by slave owners. One striking example that a number of people have pointed to in this regard is the Louisiana Purchase. Napoleon, having suffered some military defeats, reckoned that he couldn't easily hold on to these territory that became part of the Louisiana Purchase by the U.S. under Jefferson. And so Jefferson stepped in to quickly grab up this territory, to purchase it. And he did so primarily in the interest of the slave owners and in order to spread the slave-owning system into those new territories, not to develop an agrarian society based on a multitude of small, yeoman, independent farmers. And this is just one example of many that are spoken to in some of those books that I referred to of how Jefferson consistently acted not in the interests of these yeoman small farmers, but in the interests of the slave-owning class, even as not only as against the yeoman, but also their interests in conflict with those of the rising capitalist class in the North. Along with the economic dimension, the whole Southern way of life was one that depended on slavery. That was its fundamental economic basis. Even small landowners who didn't own slaves strived to get into a position to own some. And in a more personal dimension, Jefferson's political fortunes, including his election to the presidency itself, depended on slavery, and in particular, as I've spoken to elsewhere, the three-fifths provision in the Constitution, the so-called three-fifths compromise that said that slaves, for the purposes both of taxation but also of election and representation, would be counted as three-fifths of people. And as many Northerners pointed out at the time, coming from various positions and with various motives, this essentially allowed the Southern states to, by the ownership of property in the form of slaves, accumulate a lot of more votes or representation in the government by the multiplication of this property, which, of course, Northern owners of property, for example, farms or small factories, didn't get to count each factory in terms of how much representation the state would have. But the slave states got to count three-fifths of each of the slave, the total of each all the slaves, in terms of representation in the government. So this tilted things toward the Southern states in terms of the political structure from the beginning of the country. And in fact, if you look into this, you'll see that this was something that the Southern states insisted upon, or there would have been no union.
There would have been no United States. And even those in the North who on basis of moral conviction and or economic interest were opposed to slavery ended up capitulating to this. Because otherwise the South would have refused to join in the Union and there would have been no United States. Regardless of the war against England and the Declaration of Independence and all that, when it came down to it, this was a sine qua non. This was an absolute requirement for the slave-owning class in the South. And it did involve a compromise, but this compromise embodied the things that I've been speaking to, which gave a certain disproportionate power to the South, to the slave-owning class, and which enabled them to block and counter moves that would have gone in the direction of abolishing slavery. Sometimes it's claimed by, in fact, it's claimed quite often by different people that Jefferson was actually opposed to slavery and wanted to see an end to it. And you can find statements by Jefferson where he says that slavery is, in fact, a blight and that it will have the consequences down the road and so on, of a negative kind down the road and so on. And also, there have been misinterpretations of what Jefferson wrote about slavery, some of which didn't get into the final version of the Declaration of Independence, where he denounced in strong terms the, some of it did get in and some of it didn't, but denunciation in strong terms of the King of England and of the British government for supposedly imposing the slave trade on the United States. And there were ways in which Jefferson and the Virginia slave-owning class in particular were opposed to aspects of the slave trade, that is, the international slave trade, because they themselves were involved in selling slaves to other states and slave owners in other territories. And they didn't want the price of the slaves being driven down. And this is the reason fundamentally that they were opposed to the continuation, once they did oppose it, of the international slave trade. They view this entirely in property and supply and demand terms. So in reality, once again on this point, Jefferson acted in the interest of the slave-owning class, and his agrarian society turned out to be a slave-owning plantation society in reality, not a society of small, independent farming yeomen. Now, this is, of course, related to, in an overall sense, part of the larger contradiction between Jefferson's lofty-sounding statements in the Declaration of Independence about the equality of all men, note all men, and their inalienable rights, and on the other hand, the glaring fact that Jefferson not only owned slaves himself, but, as I've pointed to, consistently acted on behalf of the class of slave owners and in upholding the institution of slavery, even while voicing certain moral qualms and objections to slavery, and recognizing that it strategically embodied many problems and dangers for the new American Republic. This, again, was a very acute contradiction.
A quick reminder, you're tuned into the Michael Slate Show, and we're listening to an excerpt from Bob Avakian's talk, Communism and Jeffersonian Democracy. The subject of this excerpt is built around how Jefferson's ideal society was a reality of slavery and everything that brings with it.
Historian Edward S. Morgan, in American Slavery, American Freedom, which is cited in David Bryan Davis's book, In Human Bondage, argues that for Jefferson and other Virginian slave owners, such as George Washington and James Madison, the latter being the principal author of the U.S. Constitution, and also Madison himself became president of the United States. For figures like this, there was a certain kind of unity, a unity of opposites, as we would say, between how they viewed whites and, on the other hand, black Africans, mulattoes, and Indians. And I'm going to quote from Morgan and give a little explanation of what he's saying here to make it a little clearer. Morgan says, quote, "Racism thus absorbed in Virginia the fear and contempt that men of the upper classes in Europe, whether Whig or Tory," that is, today we would say whether liberal or conservative, felt for the inarticulate lower classes of whites or Europeans. In other words, he's saying here that this in Europe there was an open contempt on the part of the upper ruling classes and their political representatives for the inarticulate and ignorant rabble of the lower classes. But in the United States, the same thing did not find exactly the same expression, because a lot of this contempt was, if you want to put it that way, deflected and directed toward the masses of black people who were enslaved, and to, you know, overwhelmingly, especially in the South, and toward mulattoes and Indians. And then Morgan goes on. Racism made it possible for white Virginians to develop, and this is very significant in terms of the whole development of bourgeois democracy in this country. Racism made it possible for white Virginians to develop a devotion to liberty, for whites we should underline, that English Republicans had declared to be the soul of liberty. In other words, because of racism and because of excluding, essentially, from consideration as human beings deserving of freedom, of classes or groups of people such as Africans, mulattoes, and Indians, they could, at the same time, without feeling an acute contradiction, articulate, as Jefferson did in the Declaration of Independence, lofty principles of the equality of and inalienable rights of all people. They were speaking about all white people, and more specifically, all white men, dead or otherwise. And they were explicitly excluding from this these other groups of people that I've referred to, most especially the African people of African origin. And so the one went together with the other. They could feel, in large part exactly because of this exclusion, that they were speaking in a universal way about freedom, even while they represented certain particular interests, certain particular class interests, even among the whites. There was a dialectical unity there. By excluding these other groups, they could feel, even while they represented the interests of the ruling classes among whites, they could feel they were speaking in universal terms about the freedoms for all people who were not excluded, i.e. the whites. This is a very important insight. And then he goes on. He speaks about Republicans, and he doesn't mean the ruling right-wing party in the U.S. today, but people who have a Republican philosophy of government. That is to say, the general political philosophical viewpoint that is opposed, for example, to a monarchy, the best and most just form of government is a republic in which the people are said to be sovereign and have the formal right to vote and elect representatives to government in whatever form that takes place. So these people, in other words, could proclaim Republican principles and believe in them even while practicing and defending slavery as well as other forms of exploitation. And Morgan goes on, by lumping Indians, mulattoes, and Negroes in a single pariah class, that is, putting them in a category of people who were not really to be considered human in terms of the rights and freedoms that human beings should have. By lumping Indians, mulattoes, and Negroes in a single pariah class, Virginians, and here he's speaking about ruling class slave-owning Virginians in particular, Virginians had paved the way for a similar lumping of small and large planters in a single master class. Here again you see the unity between the exclusion of one and the notion of unity of all the others, even with the class divisions among them. And Morgan continues, racism became an essential, if unacknowledged, ingredient of the Republican ideology that enabled Virginians, like Jefferson and Madison, as well as Washington, to lead the nation. And this is a peculiarity or particularity of the development of bourgeois society and the principles of bourgeois democracy as they developed from the very beginning and have evolved historically in the United States. As David Bryan Davis summed it up in his recent book on slavery, Inhuman Bondage, quote, according to Morgan, racial slavery enabled Virginia's slave-owning planter class to co-opt the poorer whites and thus perpetuate a highly exploitative and unequal society under the banner of Republican liberty. And this is something very important to understand, not only in terms of the history of the founding of the country and the basis on which it was founded, but in terms of its implications and in terms of its consequences down through the history of the country, even to today. So with whatever limitations there may be in Morgan's and in Davis's overall analysis, there is definitely important truth to the fact that, first of all, the Republican ideology and notions of freedom that have characterized the way in which the United States has been conceived and ruled have indeed included racism and the oppression of black people and others whom today are often called people of color, the exclusion of them from the very beginning, from this notion of freedom, and their oppression from the very beginning and in the very foundation of the country. And there has been a definite tendency for this to contribute in various ways to blunting the overall class conflicts in society and the class consciousness of the proletarians, among the whites in particular, but also in a different way among black people and other oppressed nationalities. So all that's by way of speaking to the first irony that I mentioned, that Jefferson talked about a virtuous yeoman-based agrarian society, but actually in opposition to that, consistently upheld and fought for the interests of the slave-owning class and the agrarian society that in reality he was an embodiment and a spokesperson for, was a slave-owning plantation society.
That was Bob Avakian, chairman of the Revolutionary Communist Party, with an excerpt from his recorded talk on communism and Jeffersonian democracy. You can download and listen to the entire talk at revcom.us. Once again, that's revcom.us, R-E-V as in Victor, C-O-M.us.
And that brings us to the end of yet another show. I want to thank my assistant producer, Henry Carson, my production assistant, Jeff Pryor, and each and every one of you for tuning in. If you want to share your thoughts and ideas about the show, or if you want to volunteer to be part of the show, write to me at mslate@themichaelslateshow.com. Once again, that's mslate@themichaelslateshow.com.
We're going to be listening to a piece from Thievery Corporation, and actually it's from their album Radio Retaliation, and the song is Sound the Alarm, all right? Once again, sound the alarm. Talk to you again next week.